The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. This is the Empowerment Hour. I can promise you this, within the 60 minutes we have in front of us, you will learn things you did not know, no matter what your background or education. These will be issues that can empower you to make better, healthier, and wiser choices. I will be giving a wake-up call to Glenn Beck, don't drink the Diet Coke, if you're concerned about your vision going. I'll do a report on that from Kurt Nemo from Infowars.com. I'll also be doing a commentary from Chris Hedges on how democracy dies, lessons from a master from TruthDig.com. I will be giving you the latest on why Americans' life expectancies continue to fall behind other countries. And my guest in the second part of our program today will be Professor Carl Elliott. He will be a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds. We're going to talk about the darker side of medicine, the clinical trials, the drug reps, the ghostwriters, the PR firms, the shaky bioethic practices. But it all ends up in you going into a doctor's office and the doctor telling you, you need this, it's been proven effective and safe, you trust, you take, and you die, or are injured. So this will be very important to show you what really works in medicine, what doesn't, but how we're led to believe that things are miracle drugs and great new technologies when indeed they are not. Also, why is it that only 1 in 20 U.S. citizens eat enough whole grains? We have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. Right now, as we speak, America continues to fall in healthy places in the world to live, living a longer lifespan. Now, you have smoking in China and Japan. In fact, most places in the world, lots of smoking. And you have traffic fatalities, and you have homicides, and you have obesity. But we have those in the United States, but we are still losing a grip on life expectancy. We're going backwards now. In fact, according to the latest research, and this is based upon a 15-year survey, rates of men and women between 45 and 65 in the U.S., and 12 other nations, including Austria, Belgium, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom. Now, if you notice, with the exception of Australia, virtually all the others are in the northern latitudes, possible exception of Italy, at least southern Italy. And while the U.S. has achieved gains in the past 15 years, or at least in the last decade, now it's kind of reversing itself, and we're slipping. And in fact, we're slipping in all areas, and yet we're increasing the amount we're spending on health care. So there's an inverse phenomena here. We spend more than twice any other country on health care, and yet the countries that spend the least in the developed world are living longer and healthier lives. And women in particular are faring very bad. By a 15-year survival rates were lower than that of all the other countries. That's correct. A woman in the United States will live a shorter life with less quality of life than all the countries I just mentioned, all those other 12 nations. The U.S. ranking for 15-year life expectancy for 45-year-old men also declined, falling from 3rd to 12th. So we're dead last. When the researchers compared risk factors among the 13 countries, they found very little difference in smoking. We seem to all be smoking the same, those people who smoke. In fact, the United States had faster declines in smoking between 1975 and 2005 because we were one of the leaders in the world of, you know, a stop smoking campaign. But in terms of obesity, now there's where I believe, compounded with stress, being overweight and stress, that's why I believe that we're dying. Because we have inappropriate ways of dealing with stress. We sublimate. We don't have open and honest forums to deal with stress. Just imagine the stress today. I just finished writing a new book. Last week I got on a whole writing issue, and I stayed about 18 hours a day just writing. And I write when I'm on the road by dictating. I call my office, and I have a person there who puts on the tape recorder, and then they transcribe it and edit it, and I go over it again. But I began by talking for almost 20 pages on why we're so stressed, what we do when we are stressed, what we're encouraged to do when we're stressed, and why none of it's good for us. Whereas what we should be doing is just the opposite. Now, the trouble is that being overweight and stressed go hand in hand. It is generally found that when people are not stressed, when they're happy, when they feel good, they generally tend to take better care of themselves. When you're stressed, you tend to eat out of anxiety and comfort. You rely back on that limbic part of the brain that says when you were a kid and you were stressed out and when things weren't going right, your mom gave you something that you ate that became a comfort food. And more people, when they're stressed, go back to comfort foods. And that causes excess calories. That causes us to become overweight. And then that causes another problem. The more overweight you are, the more estrogen you're secreting. And the more cortisol you're secreting. Estrogen, cortisol end up causing cancers and C-reactive protein. And that can cause a heart attack, stroke, or cancer. People in other cultures have different ways of dealing with their frustration. We don't. So my suggestion is that we get a handle on this, because here we are bragging about the best healthcare system in the world and we don't have to change it. Well, we don't have the best healthcare system in the world. We have one of the worst. In fact, we have the worst of all the developing nations. So maybe now's time for a little humility, where we take a lesson from other people in the world of what they're doing that we're not. The latest study from the North American Menopause Society's annual meeting shows this was the first U.S. study documented reduced menopausal hot flashes and muscle and joint pain and bone health and cholesterol effects. And what they found was that the women who had more of the S-equal, which is a soy derivative product, the better it was for them. And they found that it helped their bone metabolism. It turned off the bad cholesterol. This was a 12-week study. And it also helped with hot flashes. But they're wrong. This is not the first study. I did the first study and 3 years ago. And it was published. And I was a keynote speaker along with Dr. Martin Feldman in Chicago, presenting the results to some 6,000 scientists, anti-aging experts, on how we took a group of 242 women, and over a period of 1 year, were able to reverse virtually every form of menopausal condition at that time. And we had blood chemistries showing the differences in inflammatory markers, which went way down. In fact, what was interesting is how many women, when they entered the study, didn't know that they had hepatitis C, didn't know that they had elevated homocysteine levels, which can cause a heart attack, didn't know that the first symptom of a problem with your heart is dying from a heart attack, where there are no previous symptoms at all. You just, boom, you have a heart attack and die. But after all their medical exams and all their blood workups, and then they started to change, and it took a year across the board, everything had changed. So it was the first study of its kind. The trouble is it didn't get any traction in the media, so nothing happened. And also, it's not the kind of study that the average person is going to go out and do. I've said this many times, and I'll just emphasize it again. Being healthy takes a great deal of discipline. It needn't be hard, but it need be disciplined, because every single choice you make has a cumulative effect. You'd never think that eating a piece of bread at a meal, if everything else in that meal were measured for caloric intake and caloric expenditure, let's say you're on a 2,000-calorie-a-day diet, and you had one extra piece of bread. That's all. One slice of bread. At the end of the year, you've gained 12 pounds just from that. It's cumulative, but so is all energy. Positive thoughts, positive actions, negative actions are all cumulative. And one day, the accumulation creates either a dynamic change in effect and metamorphosis. Now you have hair where you didn't. You have skin that was sagging that it's tight. You have musculoskeletal system that was waning because of lack of human or the natural hormone, and now it's back. Or on the opposite end, you tip for the worst, and then you go downhill. Remember, every single thing accumulates. And also, they're finding that a combination of passion flower or kava and a combination of L-lysine and L-arginine can help people who have anxiety. And this was published in Nutrition Journal, a major peer-reviewed journal, and they pulled the results of 24 separate studies involving over 2,000 participants. And it showed that herbal supplements can be effective without any of the side effects of your normal drugs. And this was done at the Global Neuroscience Initiative Foundation, and yet we don't hear a thing about this in the mainstream media. By the way, don't be taking a lot of iron from animal products because it's the wrong kind of iron, and that can contribute, according to the newest study done by a team at Massachusetts General Hospital, to Alzheimer's. Iron overload speeds up Alzheimer's. Dr. Rogers, the head of the hospital's neurochemistry lab, who oversaw the team's work, said, quote, the findings lay the foundation for the development of new therapies that will slow or stop the negative effects of iron buildup in patients with a progressive neurodegenerative disease, symptoms of which include memory loss, impaired judgment, disorientation, and personality changes. So a lot of people are getting way too much iron because they're eating too much meat, a major source of that iron. Whereas if you had your iron from vegetables, it's a different type of iron. And finally, fewer than 1 in 20 U.S. citizens are eating enough whole grains. Now, whole grains means really whole grains, unprocessed. Quinoa and amaranth and spelt and rye, oats, brown rice. These are your grains. And here's the latest on this. And this is from the Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. And it says the following. It says, people who eat plenty of whole grains have higher quality diets overall. This is the latest research. Less than 5% of people 19 to 50-year-olds in a long-term five-year study ate 3 servings of whole grains daily. This was published in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association. So we've been suggesting all along to have 5 to 10 servings of whole grains a day. People just aren't having it. When you do, your cholesterol can go down. You have less likelihood of colorectal cancer. You can lower your the grains themselves, especially oat, will trap a lot of the excess estrogen, which then prevents you from having the breast cancer, prostate cancer, and uterine cancer. And so whole grains, and they're really good. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
War is not the answer, for only love can come. and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you
I'd like
can
to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going into our studio right now. We have Richard and Steve. Steve is our media, social media expert. Richard Gale is our executive producer. And we also, I'm just going to just address one of the Fernando Robania on Codex Elementary. This is Gary. I'm a longtime and avid reader and listener of your magnificent program's publication documentary. I haven't heard a word from you about this news. If you were so kind to let me know your opinion, it really is very low noise information about this, and you have a great and loud voice. Thanks, Fernando. It's about President Obama's presidential order in June 15th of this year, Executive Order 13544, which mandates that the U.S. is adopting Codex Alimentarius. Fernando, we are looking into this. I will do an investigation. I will get the facts, and I will report on this later this week, as well as bring you up to date on Codex and how, starting April 1st, you won't be able to get an herb for anything anywhere in Europe. And when will that come to the United States? We'll give you the latest on that. So we are looking into it right now. Let's go into studio and say hello first to Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Gary. How are you?
Doing great.
Terrific. I'm extremely excited to announce that on October 25th, we're going to be doing an exclusive live webcast of our film, Autism, Made in the USA. And for those of you who are perhaps unfamiliar with the film, it is a Gary Knoll-produced documentary which explores the plight of autistic children in the U.S. And it's undeniably an important film that seeks to educate on root causes of the disorder, as well as shed light on the solutions. In the film, Gary pretty fearlessly poses the difficult questions that I find are often left unaddressed by similar documentaries. Questions such as, why are we seeing an increase of the epidemic of autism in young children? Is it related to the number of type of vaccines that are forced upon children at a very early age? Is it true that more than 60 vaccinations are recommended for our children before the age of 30 months? Gary not only poses these questions, but provides thoughtful answers and insights supported by real, honest-to-goodness evidence. It's an exciting and important film that I really don't think should be missed. And immediately following the video webcast, we have something really special planned, which is an hour-long web chat hosted by Gary, who will be answering questions related to autism and vaccination. Additionally, we're working on securing several really important and authoritative guest speakers who will also be answering questions and will share their unique insights on autism. Again, the date of the event is Monday, October 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern. And after the premiere screening, you'll be able to stream and rewatch the video for 24 hours, as many times as you like within that period. And you can register right at this very moment to receive information on how to sign up and be a part of the event on vaccineinitiative.org under the contact page.
Thank you, Steve. Let me put this in a broader context. We cannot show Vaccination or the multi-award-winning documentary Autism Made in the USA on television. No television station is going to air it. It is too controversial. Not that there's anything wrong with controversy. There is not. Nor are any of our facts not supported. They clearly are. We have all of our documentaries reviewed by a team of lawyers to make sure and scholars to make sure that every single fact by myself or anything in the documentary, anyone else, is fully backed up. But you have to just be realistic. In today's world, who pays for the ads on television and newspapers, magazines, and radio? More often than not, it's a single industry. It's the pharmaceutical industry, followed by the food industry. So if we're challenging the pharmaceutical industry, and we're challenging the food industry, then the people are going to say, do I want to risk losing a sponsor to promote something that may or may not find an audience? And that's why many of these documentaries that many of you have seen, you say, well, why aren't they on television? Well, it's not for want of trying. We have approached HBO and Cinemax and all the other major outlets, Discovery Channel. They're not going to touch them. Not because they're not of interest. Autism, which we're premiering, won or was official entry in 50 50 of the world's greatest film festivals and won some of the biggest events for directing and theme, etc. So everything is there. Now also, even some people within the autism movement don't want this information to come out. Not many, but some. Why? More often than not, it's not simply because they have a difference of opinion. It's because they have foundations that are well-funded by the pharmaceutical industry saying autism's real and we need more drugs in order to treat it, and we've got to find the right drugs, so let's put public money, taxpayer money, into developing new drugs by the very companies who are making vaccines that end up causing autism. The film is in three segments. It shows the children and families with autism, what it means to be autistic. It shows a 22-minute segment on the cover-up, the truth about why we have autism. And then the last part of the film is an hour and a half long, shows people who have reversed autism. Now, in and of itself, that is newsworthy, because we're not talking about one child. We're talking about dozens of children out of some 500 who have made such improvements that any one of those improvements would deserve a 60-minute piece. But when you have hundreds of children, including medical doctors' own children, and you see the medical doctors in the film, including a professor from Emory University, and these are pediatricians. So now you have a person, a mother, who is a physician, who vaccinates her child and other children, who now realizes that the autism only occurred once she gave the vaccines. And now they've gone on this road to recovery. And we go through the Dan Society, and we show all the other holistic therapies, Dr. Yurkowski, people really making good improvements. So it's never been shown before. The people are unaware of this. We have the problem and the cure. I remember when I was filming in Chicago, my final day of filming on this, and I had a whole group of people came in from all over the United States. And they were all wearing blue blazers, and they just looked terrific. And from little kids, 4 years old, to a 17-year-old. And we're filming in this gigantic ballroom at this hotel. I was just blown away. And when you're behind the camera and you're directing, you have one of those ooh-ah moments. And I looked around the room. There wasn't a dry eye in there. You hear a kid say, "I'm so happy that you didn't give up on me," saying that to his parents. He's normal. He's not only normal, he's a great athlete, he's the top of his class in a regular college, and you don't hear that from anyone else ever within the Orthodox community. You don't hear those good stories. You just hear about how we need more money, more research, more money, more drugs, more, and you have all these doctors and scientists all wanting that money, all wanting that prestige. And yet here we have the answer. We have the answer. So what I'm asking the people in this audience to do is get behind this. This is our first major pushback, where we are presenting the documents, the articles. After the premiere, which will be at 8 o'clock that night, right after the showing, I will be hosting a webinar cast live, and I'll have some of the leading medical doctors, pediatricians, scientists, activists who also believe that we know what causes autism and how to reverse it on there too. This has not happened before. This will be a really historic moment. But we need you now to get on Facebook and get on Twitter. We need you to use your blogs. We need to show that we, the people, have the power, working together for common good, help prevent autism and help those who are autistic, and help show the truth of the corruption in this system from the FDA and CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics and all the other medical organizations. So we who have no power, we who have no resources, but we have the truth, we have to speak that, and you can only speak it and have a difference if enough people speak it together. So we've created this as the pushback, positive pushback, premiere worldwide over the internet. And my goal is to have a lot of people watching and then sharing that information. And that's what causes a movement and the power of unity. So, Steve, give the information one more time.
Again, the date of the event is Monday, October 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And that's 2 weeks, 2 weeks from tonight.
That's correct. And right now, you can go onto vaccineinitiative.org, and under the contact page, you can sign up to receive information on how to sign in during the day of the event and watch the film and be a part of the web chat subsequent.
And you'll have 24 hours to watch the film as many times as you want if you can't be there at that time. But I'm trying to get as many people to make time for that, make that important, because we, the people, are speaking back to the corruption and the power, malfeasance of the entire medical industrial complex and the people who are supporting them within the medical and scientific community and the media. I don't expect the media to touch this. If they did, it would be from an antagonistic and derisive point of view. But we have to bypass them. Okay, thank you, Steve.
Very welcome.
And if you forget what he just said about Vaccine Initiative, our new website, go to GaryNoll.com or go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and you can get there by there. Let's also say hello to Richard Gales in studio. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Just a little update on the VaccineInitiative.org. And I want to share, I want to go back door on this and share this with you, because this just came to my attention just 20 minutes ago. It was a press release from the American Academy of Pediatrics for International Conference when Dr. Paul Offit was going to be their plenary speaker. The whole theme was how the anti-vaccine movement threatens America's children. And the main points of it was to look at the origins of religious and philosophical exemptions to vaccines in the U.S., which is, when, for right now, if anybody wants to have their children exempt, those are, unless there's a medical indication, those are the only routes available. What's the impact of these exemptions on vaccine rates and the spread of vaccine-preventable diseases? And then also the final one they wanted to explore was the balance between, or the lack of balance, of individual freedoms and societal good. The issue of how the pharmaceutical industrial complex, the vaccine makers, are now utilizing bioethics as a mean and framing it within social justice for their own commercial market interests. One of the questions that raises, well, why is there an anti-vaccine movement? If these vaccines were effective, if we knew they were perfectly safe, if they had a clear record of building an immune response and protecting children and adults, there wouldn't be an anti-vaccine movement. I mean, why would there be? The anti-vaccine movement basically started because people over years, over decades, over century have noted a steady trail of inconsistencies and with invested interests. And that is one of the reasons why there's an anti-vaccine movement. So the recent website that we have launched is really to try to address all those different issues. It's try to give a credence, give support to the reasons and the rationale why there should be an anti-vaccine movement, and try to expose all those inconsistencies within the vaccine pharmaceutical industrial complex that give us reason to doubt that vaccination is not purely for the benefit and well-being of children and young adults and the elderly and for pregnant moms. It's really for the shareholders, the CEOs, the corporate interests. And so this is one of the main reasons I see for the vaccineinitiative.org website.
Well, what we're doing every single day, we're putting up new articles, videos, radio, information the average person, even people within the vaccine movement, do not know. This is information that we must have. We do not tell people to vaccinate or not vaccinate. We simply say before you vaccinate, you better look at the facts, and the facts, or what you're told are the facts, are not. They can be challenged, and we are. And Richard, our staff, you, myself, and others are at the forefront in all over the world of showing what's wrong, because we are applying the principles of scholarship and intellectual challenge to their arguments, and we're showing that they're just tissues of lies. And needless to say, that makes us number one in their attack, and that's fine. We accepted that. But at least people now have really objective information. We don't have any money coming from anybody. No one. So we're not a foundation saying we want vaccine truth, but we want our medications, we're pro-vaccine, and that's what you see all over this vaccine industry, and then you follow the money trail. So we're actually showing the lies and then the truth after that. So go to Vaccine Initiative. It's there. It's a whole new public service that we're doing to help people on this issue. And who's the guest at 3 o'clock today?
Hopefully David DeGraw will be returning.
Phenomenal.
And,
phenomenal.
I'm waiting for a confirmation, Gary.
If he's on, yes. That's the beginning of showing how the elites took power and who are they. Also at that time, I will be doing a warning to Glenn Beck. Don't drink Diet Coke, from Kurt Nemo from InfoWars. And that's all about aspartame. And the fact that what was said on his radio, the show this morning, is completely wrong. We'll deal with that on that 3 o'clock show, plus David DeGraw. In just a few moments, we're going to go to our guest, Professor Carl Elliott. Thank you very much, Richard.
Okay, thank you, Gary.
And that'll be in about 3 minutes. And a commentary from myself and Chris Hedges, intermixing the two. But first, good news. Today, as promised, I am delivering to you my newest, new and improved product. This was one of the most difficult to do, and that's why I'm saving it for last. This is the new and improved red stuff, the big size, 500 grams. And what makes this new and improved? First, there's nothing in this product that's also in the none of the berries here are in the berry blast. I needed them separate. I need them in large amount. Right at the top of the list, you're getting 10,000 plus ORAC. That means it has an astronomical amount of good healing bacteria. Antioxidants, and lots of them. Next, you're getting you're getting things you don't find anywhere else. I'm giving you tomatoes, and I'm talking about big amounts. See, you can see some labels trying to duplicate all this, and they'll put, oh yeah, we have tomatoes and we have tart cherry. Yeah, how much you got? 5 milligrams? 3 milligrams? No, when you have upwards of 1,000 milligrams, almost a gram of each of these, you're giving heavy-duty industrial strength. That's why I had to have separate green stuff from greens and grains, separate red stuff from berry blast. I could put it all in one product, but you're getting tiny little amounts that wouldn't mean anything, wouldn't do anything. I want this stuff to mean something and do something at the cellular level. So here's what's in the new red stuff. Tastes great, by the way. Right at the top of the list is we have our the tomatoes, big amounts of tomatoes. Then we have the 10,000 ORAC, which means you're getting an astronomical amount of the antioxidant protection, which our bodies require. Then tart cherry, apple pectin, acerola, mangosteen, the flax prune, and here's one, it's a superstar. This is going to be the berry of the future. It is called maqui, M-A-Q-U-I. Haven't heard of it anywhere, have you? No, you haven't. One of the reasons I'm going to do this is to bring the next level. This dwarfs some of the others in what it does. And I'm the only product I know of in the world at this time that has it. Blood oranges. Also, we know how important the red wine extract is. Well, here you get the red wine extract. And mind you, a lot of people are going into a health food store and buying 50 milligrams or 100 milligrams. I'm giving you 650 milligrams of red wine extract in each serving. That's 650. I'm talking about industrial size. Then prune extract. Then another extract is called pruen, P-R-U-E-N. You've never had that before. Again, 600 milligrams. Plums, oranges, pears, pomegranate, mangoes, watermelon, papaya, passion fruit, kiwi. And bromelain is one of the most important things you can take into your body. It's a great enzyme. And then digestive enzymes. Why? Because I don't have digestive enzymes. I put a blend in here. And resveratrol, almost 200 milligrams per serving. And cinnamon, one of the most single important antioxidants, if not the most important antioxidant I know of in the world in natural form. And ginger, plus 8 billion probiotics. And green tea, 250 milligrams. So this new and improved red stuff, completely separate from berry blast, they have different ingredients and all the fruits, you're getting everything. And mind you, where the berry blast has all the antioxidants, this has got all those phytonutrients, and this has all those like resveratrol and red wine extract and green tea. So this is just a big, great, big wet kiss to your cells, your DNA. This is the best thing I know you could do. I save the best for last. And put it all together, and you got over 15,000 milligrams in there. So normally this would sell for the same price that it was before. I chose not to increase this price, but for the next 24 hours to help people out in this audience, you're going to get it at a very big reduction. All the money goes to this non-commercial radio station. You're going to get it for a $31 discount. So call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065 for the new red stuff, the new and improved red stuff, completely reformulated. None of the berries or fruits that are in this are in the Berry Blast, too completely, so that the amount that you get of each one is big, major. And I put the milligrams of each ingredient. You go to all those other products and look how tiny, 1, 2, 5, 10 milligrams. No, we're talking about 1,000 milligrams of a lot of this stuff. So you're getting industrial strength, the amount to really make a difference in your cell. And you take them both. I do. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. In just a moment here, Professor Carl Elliott, medical doctor, professor at the Center for Bioethics and the Departments of Pediatrics and Philosophy at the University of Minnesota. In the past, he has taught at McGill University, Montreal, University of Chicago, Princeton University, and Universities of New Zealand, South Africa. Professor Elliott's research focuses on the intersection of medicine and the market and corporate business practices. He offers an interesting dissenting voice. And his recent book is White Coat, Black Hat, Adventures on the Dark Side of Medicine. And it's an extraordinary investigation into some of the greatest con games in modern medicine today. Well, welcome aboard, sir. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm going to come to you in just a moment, but I also want to do a brief commentary that actually leads in at some of what we're going to discuss. So if you could just bear with me for a moment or two here, all right?
Sure.
The ancient Greek playwright Aristophanes spent his life battling the assault on democracy by tyrants. It is disheartening to remind us that he lost. But he understood that the hardest struggle for humankind is often stating and understanding the obvious. Aristophanes, who had the timidity to portray the ruling Greek tyrant Cleon as a dog, is the perfect playwright to turn to in trying to grasp the danger posed to us by movements from the Tea Party to militants to the Christian right, as well as the bankrupt and corrupt power elite that no longer concerns itself with the needs of its citizens. He saw the same corruption 2,400 years ago. He feared correctly that it would extinguish Athenian democracy, and he struggled in vain to rouse Athenians from their slumber. There is a yearning by tens of millions of Americans, lumped into a diffuse and fractious movement, to destroy the intellectual and scientific rigor of the Enlightenment. They seek out of ignorance and desperation to create a utopian society based upon biblical law. They want to transform America's secular state into a tyrannical theocracy. These radicals, rather than the terrorists who oppose us, are, in my opinion, the gravest threat to our open society. They have, with the backing of hundreds of millions of dollars in corporate money, gained tremendous power. They peddle pseudoscience as intelligent design in our schools. They keep us locked into endless and futile wars of imperialism. They mount bigoted crusades against gays, immigrants, liberals, and Muslims. They turn our judiciary in the name of conservative values over to corporations. They have transformed our liberal class into hand puppets for corporate power. and we remain meek and supine. They want to transform America's secular state into a tyrannical theocracy. These radicals, rather than the terrorists, are concerned to me. The huge amount of taxpayer money doled out to Wall Street, investment banks, the oil and natural gas industries, and the defense industry, along with the dismantling of our manufacturing sector, is why we are impoverished. It is why our houses are being foreclosed on. It is why some 45 million Americans are denied medical care. It is why our infrastructure, from public schools to bridges, is rotting. It is why many of us cannot find jobs. We are being fleeced. The flagrant theft of public funds and rise of an obscenely rich oligarch class is masked by the tough talk of demagogues, themselves millionaires, who use fear and bombast to keep us afraid, confused, and enslaved. Aristophanes saw the same psychological and political manipulation undermine the democratic state in ancient Athens. He repeatedly warned Athenians in plays such as The Clouds and the Wasps and the Birds and the Frogs that permitting political leaders who shout, "I shall never betray the Athenian," or "I shall keep up the fight in defense of the people forever," to get their hands on the state funds and the power would end with citizens enslaved. "The truth is, they want you, you see, to be poor," Aristophanes wrote in his play, The Wasps. "If you don't know the reason, I'll tell you. It is to train you to know who your tamer is. Then, whenever you hear a whistle and it sets against you an opponent of his, you jump out of fear and then tear them to pieces." Our democracy, through years of war, theft, and corruption, is being diminished. But the example Aristophanes offers is not a hopeful one. He held up the same corruption to his fellow Greeks. He repeatedly chided them for not rising up and fighting back. He warned ominously that by the time most citizens awoke, it would be too late, and he was right. The appearance of normality lulls us into a false hope and submission. Those who shout most loudly in defense of the ideals of the Founding Fathers, the sacredness of the Constitution, and the values of the Christian religions are those who most actively seek to subvert the principles they claim to champion. They hold up the icons and language of traditional patriotism, the rule of law, and Christian charity to demolish the belief system that gives them culture and political legitimacy. And those who should defend these beliefs are cowed and silent. All ideological, theological, and political debates with the representatives of the corporate state, including the feckless and weak Barack Obama, are useless. They cannot be reached. They do not want a dialogue. They care nothing for real reform or participatory democracy. They use the tricks and mirage of public relations to mask a steadily growing assault on our civil liberties, our inability to make a living, and loss of basic services from education to health care. Our gutless liberal class placates the enemies of democracy, hoping desperately to remain part of the ruling elite rather than resist. In many ways, liberals, because they serve as a cover for those corporate extremists, are our greatest traitors. Aristophanes, too, lived in a time of endless war. He knew that war always empowered anti-democratic forces. He saw how war ate away at the insides of a democratic state until it was hollowed out. The tragedy is that liberals and secularists, like Obama, are not viewed as competitors by the corporate force that hold power, but as contaminants that must be eliminated. They have sought to work with forces that will never be placated. They have abandoned the most basic values of the liberal class to play a game that in the end will mean their political and cultural extension. There will be no swastikas this time, but seas of red, white, and blue flags and Christian crosses. There will be no stiff-arm salutes, but recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance. There will be no brown shirts, but nocturnal visits by Homeland Security. The fear, rage, and hatred of our dispossessed and confused working class are being channeled in currents that are undermining the last vestiges of the democratic state. In conclusion, these dangerous emotions directed against a liberal class that, as in ancient Athens, betrayed the population, have a strong appeal. And unless we adopt the radicalism held by Aristophanes, unless we begin to hinder the functioning of the corporate state through acts of disobedience, we are finished. Let us not stand at the open gates of the city meekly waiting for the barbarians. They are coming. They are slouching towards Bethlehem. Let us, if nothing else, like Aristophanes, begin to call our tyranny by its name. Chris Hedges. Sir, Now, and I don't, I only had to do this because I felt it was so important. But in some respects, my question to you then becomes, when you look at the history of medicine as practice historically and today, when you look at the promises made by those in positions of power, what has happened to the right and the obligation of a physician to practice medicine as that person deems best with a patient without fear or concern that somehow that is not honoring the corporate state or those who are in a position to profit from how medicine is practiced?
Well, I like the phrase hand puppets to corporate power from your prologue. In a certain way, that's what's happened to medicine. You know, medicine has, over the past 25 years, been largely transformed from a profession to a business. And the opportunities for temptation and corruption have just become enormous. Not just for individual physicians, but for, you know, an entire range of new business opportunities in medicine that just hardly existed 25, 30 years ago.
Could you go into those, please?
Well, there are a lot of them. One that I got really interested in the book are the for-profit clinical research testing sites that have sort of emerged over the past 20 years or so. I mean, what's happened is that in the old days when drug companies were interested in testing their drugs, they would partner with academic physicians working in medical schools. And it was seen as a relatively equal partnership. Whether that was true or not, I'm not sure. What's happened is that pharmaceutical companies have found it much cheaper and more efficient to contract with private contract researchers in private testing sites rather than go through medical schools. And so what's happened is, for example, when drugs are tested for safety, every drug has to be tested for safety before it can be tested on sick people for effectiveness. Those safety tests are done largely in for-profit private testing sites, and people are paid to check into these testing sites for 1, 2, 3 weeks at a time, take untested drugs in exchange for money to see if they're okay or not. And the problem with that, for me, is that by turning that into a market-based system, what has happened is that the burden of testing the safety of drugs has fallen largely on the poor. I mean, these are largely the people who test these drugs are largely the people who are desperate for money. So undocumented immigrants, unemployed people, contract workers, graduate students, people freshly out of prison who can't get work otherwise. In other words, anyone with the need for money and the time to be able to check into a testing facility for 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Could you, thank you for that answer. Could you give us an idea of what are some of the problems that you have found with the way clinical studies are done today, where we hear about a miracle drug and frequently hear about that in a media that has not done its homework? It is simply taking what is coming from the pharmaceutical PR firm and simply giving it a form. So take us through the whole idea of clinical trials, that people make the money from those clinical trials, and what we should know that we don't.
Well, the problems all come with the fact that the testing process has been turned over solely to the market. So, for example, now the testing of drugs is largely managed by specialized companies known as contract research organizations, or CROs. And these are the companies that will take the drug from clinical development all the way through approval by the FDA. Drug companies used to do that themselves, and now they contract it out to CROs. CROs are themselves very large corporations. It used to be when drug testing was done in universities, the trials, the research studies, had to be approved, the ethics of the studies had to be approved by ethics committees known as IRBs or institutional review boards. Now that it's done in the private sector, they are often approved by for-profit IRBs or for-profit ethics boards. And those boards are paid in full by the pharmaceutical companies that are testing the drugs. And so they have a built-in conflict of interest. They have a financial incentive to certify the studies as safe before they go ahead. Once the trials are done and the studies are complete, they'll often be written up for publication by professional ghostwriters. These are medical education companies which have taken over the writing up of research studies for medical journals. They're also paid by the pharmaceutical companies. They have professional medical writers on hand who write up the studies, and then academic physicians, people working in medical schools like mine, are paid to put their name on the study. So it will look as if it came from a reputable medical school when, in fact, it's been ghostwritten by a for-profit medical education firm. And so, from start to finish, the incentives are all in the wrong places. And the incentives are to sell the drug, not to produce the truth.
How often have you found that we are told about some miracle drug, and we believe it? We want to believe it because we want to believe that we have ethics and decency. And the FDA says nothing that would counter that. Then a panel of experts that the FDA has brought together agrees. There's a consensus. At least 6 out of 10 people on the panel say yes. So then for the average physician, the average public health official, the average legislator, the average person in the media, and the average citizen, if it's gone through all this, then it must be good in safety and efficacy. And yet we're never shown all those clinical studies that failed. We're never shown what would happen if this was used purely against a placebo or against a person who was living a very healthy lifestyle and a placebo and against the drug. They never designed the drug to see what would happen, for example, if you took vitamin D and vitamin C and exercise and gave up all these foods that are bad for you and fried foods, and compare that with a drug against the common cold and then against a placebo. So we never know what we're not told. And yet I'm doing a major film now on genetic engineering. And I've interviewed scientists from inside the genetic engineering field who say that some of the experiments came out so bad that it was worse than what you would have seen in a sci-fi film. And yet none of that has ever gone to the public because they have to sign confidentiality agreements. One man said there were over 80 experiments that went bad. The one that didn't go bad was the only one that they reported on, as if all these other bad ones didn't happen. So I'd like for you to address that next. I'm just going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. You can continue listening to this program by going over to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNall.com. My guest, Professor Carl Elliott, and he will be with us for at least another 10 minutes or more. And then at 3 o'clock, a whole hour coming at you. So could you please address those, sir?
Well, what happens with the FDA is the FDA is in the business of determining whether or not drugs are safe or effective. They usually require 2 successful clinical trials against placebo to certify a drug as effective, 2 positive, successful clinical trials. But, the problem is that a pharmaceutical company can do as many clinical trials as it wants, many of which won't be successful. And those don't really matter. So, you know, you could have 20 failed clinical trials and only two successful ones, and the drug could be approved. Once the drug goes onto the market, it's being given to many, many more people than it was given to in the clinical trials, which have been submitted to the FDA. And what that means is that side effects that are rare, because of the fact that you're testing them, and I mean, they're being given to a much larger group of patients, start turning up. And so as a result of a lot of drugs that have been approved are eventually withdrawn from the market. Now, what's alarming is, I mean, and what we found out with litigation, you know, over Vioxx, Zyprexa, Seroquel, you know, a whole range of drugs over the past 10 or 15 years, is that the companies which are producing these drugs knew about the side effects before they were approved, but have been burying or spinning or manipulating the studies to downplay those risks. And that is possible because none of the rest of us have access to their data. They publish what they want to publish. Even the so-called authors of the trials, the academics who were recruited to put their names on the studies, often they don't even have access to the data. The problem, you know, the larger problem is that, you know, by turning science into a market-driven activity, the ethos of openness, which ought to be there, just isn't.
Okay. Increasingly during the past decade, we see our airwaves and television commercials inundated with drug advertisements addressing consumers rather than the professional medical industry. And as you know, it is not advertising that increases blind faith in the population, but public relations. For example, orchestrated slick video news releases that the drug makers fund and that now appear on 90% of television stations. And also what I find frightening is that drug makers and their PR firms are permitted to manipulate public service announcements, or PSAs, for their own commercial benefit and basically not pay for them to be broadcast because they're PSAs. So please take us through this entire marketing industry that is being used by the pharmaceutical industry to sell us drugs.
Well, a VNR, video news release, is a piece of video produced for often a corporation, but also often a nonprofit group or a government entity, which is designed to be indistinguishable from news and which is broadcast as news, often on local television stations. And so, for example, if a pharmaceutical company wants to publicize their drug, they can commission a video news release about some event related to their drug. Say it's just been approved by the FDA, for example. They can commission a video news release, which is allegedly the video equivalent of a press release, about their drug, send it out, and it will often be broadcast on, or at least until recently, was often broadcast on television news stations as news. And if you're watching the news, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish between legitimate news, which has been produced by the broadcaster, and a video news release, which may have been produced by a pharmaceutical company or a government agency. To me, this is much more dangerous than advertising, because at least with advertising, you know that you're watching an ad. With video news releases, you think that you're watching the news, when in fact, it's essentially advertising masquerading as news.
I'm sure you've seen in a lot of the ads, a side effect is mentioned very quickly and with a lot of visual cover, what we call B-roll.
Right.
But some of these side effects are death, especially with Celebrex. I heard death three times in that commercial as a side effect. Well, it's not a side effect, then. It is an effect. And why can't we be intellectually honest?
Well, it's not the intended effect, I think. I think that's probably, the defense that the drug maker would use. But I sympathize with that complaint.
And also, how about the way that they magically, they must have gotten some lessons from how the government releases its statistics on unemployment, when we all know that the real number is closer to 19%. They're saying 9.6%, but here's what the drug industry did. And I did this in an article on chemotherapy. A very popular chemotherapy drug was being promoted, saying that it had 50% improvement in efficacy as far as longevity. But when I read the actual study, the life expectancy of someone who did not take the drug was about 16 months. The person who took the drug, it was 19 months. So you live 3 months longer, and then they got to say, oh, it was statistically significant. In the real realm, it's not. You know, it's not like 5 years without the drug and 10 years with it. Sometimes the difference was only 1 month. And yet the cost of that drug was astronomical, and the side effects were debilitating. So they play with these numbers, and yet we don't have boards of science oversight. We don't have a populist raconteur. We do not have people looking out for the public's interests, and so they can literally say and do what they want. Your thoughts?
Well, the FDA is supposedly in charge of monitoring drug advertisements. The difficulty is that the FDA is so understaffed for this that essentially anything can get through. And by the time the FDA finds out about it, or someone makes a complaint to the FDA that they investigate, the period in which the advertisement is run is finished, and it's basically done its job anyway. So oversight of drug advertising is fairly minimal as far as I can tell.
My final question is in your specific area of bioethics. How critical are you of other bioethic colleagues who, for a very large amount of money, are willing to distort the relationship between medicine? For example, taking a particular drug with social justice. So would you speak about how bioethics has become, to some, a public relations con? And one of the best examples I can think of is the flu vaccine, where those who refuse it are now being regarded as criminals who threaten the well-being of others. And, of course, they don't go into the gray area that questions the flu vaccine's efficacy or safety, since if you are inoculated with a flu vaccine, you are supposed to be protected from those who aren't vaccinated. Yet every one of the 6 flu vaccines approved this season state explicitly on their product information inserts, quote, vaccination with the given vaccine may not protect all recipients, unquote. And as the Cochrane database vaccine group headed by Dr. Thomas Jefferson has shown, flu vaccination has an extremely low efficacy rate, and in small children it was no better than a placebo. And yet people are made to feel like criminals if they don't get their flu vaccine. So share in this final comment on this, what I consider manipulation of bioethics and social justice, and explain how that might benefit the drug manufacturers.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to the flu vaccine. I just don't know about that. But with bioethics, the issue has been that mainly over the past 15 years or so, bioethics has become largely located in academic health centers, in medical schools, and the norms that govern academic health centers and medical schools have come to govern bioethics as well. What I think has happened is that bioethics has been co-opted by the mission of academic health centers, so that it's essentially kind of a public relations arm. What has happened, I think, even more worryingly over the past probably 10 or 12 years, is that the amount of pharmaceutical industry funding that's coming in, that has moved into bioethics has increased. And so now you're seeing bioethicists working as consultants to the pharmaceutical industry. You're seeing them working as advisors on advisory boards for the biotech industry and also for pharma as well. And you're seeing pharmaceutical industry money flow into medical schools to support bioethics centers and to fund chairs and positions in bioethics. You know, that, to me, is a blatant conflict of interest. I mean, it, you know, for someone in my position, you know, teaching about pharmaceutical industry practices, sitting on ethics review boards that are dealing with pharmaceutical industry policies, possibly working in government positions that have to do with the issues of relevance to the pharmaceutical industry, to then be on the payroll of the pharmaceutical industry, that I think is a huge conflict of interest. And what is shocking to me is that bioethicists, many bioethicists, don't see it as a problem, even as they criticize physicians for working as paid consultants for the pharmaceutical industry. The position seems to be that it's a conflict of interest for a doctor to do this, but not for someone in bioethics, which seems, you know, hypocritical to me.
Well, I appreciate your book, White Coat, Black Hat, Beacon Press, and all the good work that you're doing to keep us in the loop on reminding us about the importance of ethics in medicine and in science. Thank you very much, Professor Carl Elliott, for being on today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Knoll. That's it for today's show. In 2 hours, a whole hour, hopefully with David DeGraw, we have a lot to share, and we'll be taking calls at that time. Have a nice day, everyone, and stay tuned right here on the Progressive Radio Network, as coming at you right now is The Natural Nurse with Dr. Z.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.